You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House. Coming to you live from Studio One, I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, drug decriminalisation, pros and cons with various examples from around the world. I'll be debating that with regular guests Shashank Joshi of RUSI and Oscar Guardiola Rivera of Birkbeck University. We'll also look towards Bangkok, where authorities appear little the wiser about who bombed the city's Erawan shrine on Monday with such dreadful consequences, or why. We'll find out why things have escalated so quickly along the border between the two Koreas, and how much danger there is that they might get worse still. And we'll look at the UK's deal with France over the migrant crisis in Calais and ask whether it's a solution or something they're hoping we'll mistake for one. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And a very warm welcome to the show. My guests today are Shashank Joshi, Senior Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute here in London, and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Senior Lecturer in Law at Birkbeck University of London, author of What If Latin America Ruled the World, both regular guests here on Midori House. Welcome both. We will start in Bangkok, where there does appear to have been little, if any, progress in identifying, much less apprehending, the perpetrator of Monday's bombing of the Erawan Shrine, which killed 20 people and left dozens injured, many seriously. Two men shown on CCTV of the scene just before the bombing have handed themselves in, though this seems to have been more a case of eliminating themselves from the inquiries, and indeed within the last few minutes they have been cleared. Shashank, first of all, it is now, what are we getting on, more than 72 hours comfortably since the bombing. We still haven't had any claim of responsibility. Does it start to look more like it might just be the sort of strange context-free act of a random maniac who just wanted to blow something up?
Well, you know, terrorism involves a political objective, and so you can have acts of mass casualty violence that are not terrorism. But in this particular case, the Thai authorities seem convinced there's a network involved, even if they've misidentified some of the people in that purported network. And, you know, the scale of this explosion seems to suggest there is some kind of serious motive behind this, rather than just what we would see in, say, a mass shooting in a cinema or something.
That's what I'm wondering, whether it is time to maybe think of it as more akin to that.
It's certainly one of the possibilities, you know, we have to keep open. I think it's interesting also the Thai authorities think there was a possibility of disguise used by the perpetrator. Again, it would be a very, very strange thing to have someone conduct an operation like this and then melt away. What would be their purpose? Normally, for example, you might see a gunman commit suicide or stay around for the glory. What's the motivation here? Still completely, completely absent.
Oscar, as Shashank points out, the Thai authorities have made or have offered some hints as to their thinking, but taken as one sort of collection, they don't make a great deal of sense. They've said that the prime suspect is foreign, but they've also said that there's no link with international terrorism. Right. They suspect a network of up to 10 people, though they haven't favoured us with any reasonings as to who these 10 people might be or why they did it. Forgive me for sounding cynical, but they are sounding like an awful lot of people who are trying to avoid saying out loud, we don't have the least idea who did this or why.
I think you're not being cynical. I think you're absolutely spot on. Not only that, we have reports from journalists according to which forensic teams have not even collected all the evidence. There is still shrapnel from the bomb to be found on the walls. That's not the kind of careful investigation that you would expect after something of this kind has happened.
Countries run by military dictatorships are notorious for their careful efficiency in public administration and you know, investigation of massive criminal acts, I've found in my look at, you know, experience of the Middle East and South Asia.
Indeed. So, Shashank, I was trying to think, is there any precedent for what, by every impression, is a terrorist action done for no readily admitted or at least extremely opaque motive? Thinking maybe of the sort of the Bader-Meinhof attacks of the 1970s, who his political the political ambitions behind them were vague, to say the very least.
Yeah, that's true. I would say there are many, many Islamist terrorist attacks, religiously motivated terrorist attacks, that actually don't have claims of responsibility for days or weeks afterwards. If you remember attacks in Turkey that took place in Istanbul, I think probably 11 years ago now, one of them was against the British consulate. There was huge uncertainty about this. It was probably Al-Qaeda-linked franchises. The Turks much afterwards blamed their usual little pet project of, you know, a conspiracy within Turkey by army officials and so on. But responsibility can take a long time to come out in some cases. If there's tight operational security by a group, sometimes they won't release videos for fear it'll come back to them. So I'd say we have to hold on a little while before we conclude there is not some sort of organized political motive behind this. I think the really puzzling thing for me is the mismatch in scale and target between what we have seen and what has normally been practiced by every indigenous Thai group, particularly the separatists in the south. That mismatch is huge. And so I'm left wondering, you know, which indigenous group could it possibly be?
Well, this has been pointed out, that while terrorist violence is hardly unknown in Bangkok, it tends to be of a much smaller scale than this. I mean, this is a hideous massacre by any standards. I mean, I suppose it's even vaguely possible that perhaps it was a terrorist group that hadn't anticipated that it would do this much damage, and they're now rather hiding from the consequences.
Yeah, that does happen sometimes. Terrorist groups realise belatedly that their actions can repel public support. In this particular case, you know, add it to that long list of hypotheses.
A final thought on this, Oscar. How badly or how well do you think the Thai government are handling this? If we do extend them the sympathy that they are the government of a country which has been the victim of a dreadful, dreadful crime, which isn't clearly the easiest one to solve, and they deserve, I think, every sympathy on that front, but how well are they actually handling it?
As I suggested before, pretty badly. Again, you don't conduct a serious investigation on a crime of this scale by leaving important forensic traces all over your crime scene for other, you know, for foreign journalists to find. Also, as was pointed out before, the mismatch between the hypothesis that we have heard so far and both factual precedents and the current results of the investigation is very clear. So they tell us that evidence points towards a southern separatist group. But again, they have never done anything of this scale, and there isn't a motive that would explain why they would do so right now. So it is clear that the Thai authorities are none the wiser.
Okay, well, let's take a look now at Brazil. Now, no sane person disputes that the war on drugs waged around the world more or less since the end of the Second World War has been both monstrously expensive and, on its own terms, a more or less total failure, if not actually counterproductive. As a consequence, some countries and locales have begun to experiment with, or at least discuss, decriminalisation. Brazil is the latest. The Supreme Court has begun debating a case which could lead to a decriminalisation of possession of drugs for personal use. Oscar, first of all, Brazil's now actually one of the few countries in Latin America where possession for personal use is still a crime. Would decriminalization be popular in Brazil?
I think it will, although rather, you know, given the current political context, I'm pretty certain that the opposition will try to use that, particularly because the opposition is linked to broadly conservative evangelical and Episcopalian churches. So that sector of Brazil's society will see these as part of the slippery slope towards chaos, communism, and all sorts of devilish things. But the fact of the matter is that Brazil is just arriving late to taking a measure which by no standards could be seen as, you know, challenging the whole template on drugs policy. What is at stake in this particular case is the decriminalization of possession. So if you have, you know, a certain amount of drugs that are deemed to be there for your personal use, most other constitutional courts and supreme courts in the region have acknowledged that this is you know, just a private issue. but it is important insofar as it raises again the issue that you pointed to at the beginning of this note, the fact that the war on drugs is a moral, political and economic failure.
Shashank, looking at the wider picture beyond Brazil, is it not increasingly the case, certainly across the Western world, that most countries have in practice decriminalized possession of a lot of drugs for personal use, at least for middle-class white people?
Very ethnically selectively, yes. I think, you know, there's very different experiences here. The one I find really interesting is Portugal's, which led the way in comprehensive decriminalization across the board. And, you know, this was a sort of laboratory for many of these policies. And 5 years afterwards, they found, you know, to the surprise of many, many people, this was a resounding success. You saw HIV rates drop. You saw, you know, lifetime marijuana use in people above the age of 15 fall to about 10% compared to 40% in the United States. Rates of usage falling in many other areas, crime falling. So, you know, the evidence-driven approach is a pretty clear one.
Oscar, that being the case, why does it still seem to be so hard for, say, for example, the leader of a well-known first world country just to stand, and certainly some have hinted at it. Barack Obama admitted in his own memoirs to drug use as a young man. The Prime Minister of this country has certainly been somewhat evasive on the subject of his own history. But what is stopping one of them from just standing up and saying, look, this doesn't work? We all know this doesn't work. It's ridiculous.
Because it makes you look as weak on crime. At least that's their fear. Also because we're very unfortunate to have leaders, particularly in our countries here in the first world, we're not really ready to lead. They pander to an audience, and their polls tell them very often that if they were to, to pursue a reasonable approach towards drugs, a more liberalizing approach, they would be seen as weak, as soft, and the electorate will react against them. That's why they don't do it. They don't do it in public, but they
I'm not sure I understand. I can't understand myself why, if that's the case, it is the case, because I certainly say in Britain in 2015, it would be vanishingly unusual to find, I would think, a single citizen who does not have at least friends who have regularly, frequently taken illegal drugs and really don't appear to be any the worse for it than people who would drink alcohol or smoke tobacco.
I think there's an issue here of priority and salience. In a political moment in our country, how high up the agenda is drugs liberalisation in terms of the centre ground for which politicians are clambering? It's a vanishingly low importance issue for the type of constituencies they're going for. You've got, you know, issues like the economy, migration, foreign policy, all kinds of other stuff. It's simply the case that, you know, this is a third tier issue. I think within the governing party as well, Cameron already took a reasonable risk during the coalition in terms of his movement on gay marriage. This was something, you know, that was pretty innovative for him to do from where he was in the party. He just doesn't have that much political capital to go throw away, particularly now the Tory right wing and the back benches are stronger than they were a few months ago.
It's worth mentioning, though, here that here in the UK, the All-Party Parliamentary Group for Drug Policy Reform has called for looking into regulated marijuana markets, at least. And a UK government study last year concluded that tough penalties have absolutely no impact whatsoever on drug use. Oscar, looking at South America, where you are from, where, of course, it's much more of an urgent issue in that, you know, actual wars are still being fought over this, possibly at the moment, most notably in Mexico. Would even more widespread decriminalization, would it have the effect often hoped for of that if you decriminalize something, you remove criminals from the marketplace?
It is very likely. There are, again, there is evidence of that in sectors of Colombia's capital, in Bogota, for instance, where such programs have been applied. And again, what is very important is the disconnect that there is between political agendas in the first world and political agendas in the third world. Because although it is the case that, as mentioned before, this is not an issue in the first world, in places like Latin America and so on, this is connected to geopolitics and the foreign policies of first world countries. And in a sense, part of the reason why, although the evidence on the ground suggests that the results of decriminalization will be positive. More countries, other countries, rather than Uruguay, and to a certain extent Bolivia, have not taken the same path, has to do precisely with the fact that there seems to be no potential dialogue partner on the other side, on the first world.
Shashank, do you think there is anything to the contrary argument, which is still, it's certainly in this country at least, more or less confined to the op-ed pages of the Daily Mail, that the problem is not that the laws exist, is that they are not stringently enforced, that this laxity has grown, and that if, say, tomorrow the police went out and actually rounded up every middle-class white cocaine user, although that yeah. might make it a bit difficult to put one or two newspapers out, that all of a sudden drugs would vanish from our streets?
Yeah, I for one am in favour of a massive gutting of the entirety of Hampstead in a single clean sweep over the weekend.
What about the city?
That's second round two, I think. That's a bigger task. That's the Mosul of the drugs market.
Yeah, we have to apportion resources here, Osgood.
Look, I think the fact is we've got a natural experiment, which is that enforcement has changed over time, as you implied earlier on. Enforcement has genuinely loosened up over the last 15, 20 years. Over that period, has there been the kind of corresponding degeneration of public morals and public criminality, not in the way that Peter Hitchens talks, rages about on a weekly basis. So I just don't buy it.
And Oscar, if you took the same approach to South America, the idea that maybe if we crack down even harder, would that actually get us anywhere, or would it just, and I'm guessing your answer already, or would it make things even worse?
It would destroy the economy of a couple of countries I can think of. I'm not going to mention names just now. But actually, again, the results would be resoundingly positive. And there is a very peculiar consensus here. Right-wing, center, left-wing leaders in Latin America, they all agree that the drug on wars, the war on drugs has been a total failure. And they have been looking for ways to, experiment with other potential and more effective programs.
We will conclude this discussion on that point, but I couldn't get out of my head while I was sort of writing up the notes for this. There was, not for the first time, The Onion, the satirical newspaper, called it exactly right with one of their headlines a few years ago, which was just drugs win, drugs war. we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Shashank Joshi from RUSI and Oscar Guardiola Rivera from Birkbeck University. Coming up after a very short break, Korea's demilitarized zone appears to be having one of its interludes of being militarized, and the UK and France claim to have reached agreement about the refugees attempting to reach the former from the latter.
Do you have dreams of running your own business? Or do you just wish you had a nicer desk? Well, you require the September issue of Monocle that comes with an entrepreneurial dusting of good advice, inspiring stories, and contacts for better office furniture. And we have more.
In culture, we take the temperature of Brazil's largest media company, Globo, as things hot up. It's celebrating its 50th birthday ahead of the Rio Olympics and accusations of monopoly.
In the design pages, we enlist the help of four of our favourite architects to kit out the office of startups throughout their life cycle.
In the edit section, we sip cider in the Big Apple, unearth Byron Bay's growing food scene, and travel to the latest hotel openings from Barcelona to Perth.
The September issue of Monocle is on sale now. Get your copy at any good newsstand or do the wise thing. Become a subscriber at monocle.com.
Join Monocle 24's international editors and correspondents as they touch down in a different city each week for our brilliant new travel programme. Come on board for a one-stop audio guide to the most dynamic emerging cities around the world. The journey begins this week in Bamako. As well as hospitality highlights and key cultural hotspots, we'll also visit new retail spaces, sample the local food scene, and meet the design denizens that a potentially time-poor traveller can ill afford to miss. The Voyager, in association with Turkish Airlines, is now boarding.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Shashank Joshi, Senior Research Fellow at RUSI here in London, and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Senior Lecturer in Law at Birkbeck University. Now, even the most ardent enthusiast of K-pop, and I'm sure quite a few of them listen to Monocle 24, would surely concede that it is something of a niche taste. That said, artillery fire does seem something of an overreaction. Overreaction being, however, pretty much North Korea's only export, we shouldn't be surprised that North Korea has responded to South Korea's recent resumption of cross-border propaganda broadcasts, K-pop included, with shelling. South Korea has now fired back. No injuries are reported, though Pyongyang is threatening the usual lake of fire if Seoul doesn't give their loudspeakers a rest. Shashank, we got here, as I understand it, because two South Korean soldiers were very seriously injured by a landmine in the DMZ. South Korea restarted its propaganda loudspeakers, which had lain dormant, mercifully, one would think, for some years. North Korea then restarted its propaganda loudspeakers. They seem now to have followed that up with artillery. South Korea have responded. Are we on the verge here of the first K-pop war?
First K-pop war? I think probably not. As you point out, the North Koreans are more fan of lurid threats of the lake of fire and so on than actually, you know, serious follow-up. I think what's interesting is how regimes like North Korea's are typically much, much more threatened by intellectual challenges, threats to propaganda, threats to their legitimacy messages, than they are to military build-ups and the such like. You see this in the fact that Iran's response to the possibility of a McDonald's was enormously greater than its response to a build-up of American ships in the Persian Gulf. And I think that's a really interesting insight into the mentality of autocratic states. But I'm really interested not just in the fact that as speakers, this is a multifaceted propaganda war. And I remember two years ago, the use of South Korean balloons. You remember those?
Which they did also answer with artillery fire, seeming something of an overreaction.
That's right. I mean, that's a response to a children's birthday party with artillery.
Did they pop any balloons?
that would have been some fancy shooting. Yeah.
But I think it's worth emphasizing one more thing, which is a context to this, is of course also the annual US-South Korean exercises. I remember about 2 years ago that there was a huge kerfuffle during those exercises, and the US sent nuclear-armed bombers over Korea as a result. They always play up at this time of year. It's an annual thing, effectively. So it's not entirely surprising to me it goes away in due course.
Oscar, is this merely a kerfuffle, or has it now escalated to a brouhaha?
it is like my neighbors when they don't like the boogaloo I'm playing in my very loud speakers, but they have never resorted to shelling, not yet. It is a kerfuffle. It is, as Joshi pointed out correctly, this happens every year when the US and South Korea engage in, collaborative exercises. It is most probably the case that we don't have to make more of this, other than the North Koreans, again, appealing to their usual brouhahas.
Well, look, finally tonight, we should look closer to home. And now, though the numbers involved, it has to be said, would seem laughable to any listeners in Turkey, Jordan, or even Germany, the British media this summer has been dominated by the efforts of a few thousand migrants camping near the French port of Calais to gain access to the UK via the Channel Tunnel. Nine have died this summer attempting the crossing. Today, Britain's Home Secretary Theresa May and her French counterpart Bernard Cazeneuve signed a deal on new measures to deal with the crisis. Shashank, this includes that they seem terribly pleased with their jointly run control and command centre, which will pursue people smuggling gangs. Britain's also going to pay for migrants to be processed and repatriated back whence they came. Is any of this going to have any significant deterrent effect?
I think it'll have an effect on the margin, but of course what's driving this is a huge and substantial flow of migrants from a variety of conflicts, particularly from North Africa, but also in the Levant. And that supply side is going to swamp any short-term law enforcement response that the Brits and the French can come up with. I think it's probably a sensible thing to recognise. The problem is not necessarily physically in Calais, it's in some of the smaller towns and cities in France where these smuggling networks operate from, but they are of course just responding to that huge, huge supply that is geopolitically, structurally built in for the time being.
Oscar, they're also talking about, as they continually are, beefing up security around the entrance to the Channel Tunnel to make it less accessible. Does that solve the problem, or does it just then encourage people to, and I'm frankly surprised we haven't seen it yet, attempting to cross the channel by boat?
Well, we'll see it, I'm sure. They want us to believe that they have come up with a solution, but they have not come up with a solution. The very idea that because you're being paid your return ticket to Syria, you will go back after having pretty much given up on all hope and after risking your life crossing the Mediterranean is, of course, nonsense. It will not work. This is a humanitarian catastrophe. We know more about what is happening in Calais, but we should also learn much more about what is happening in the Greek islands there because of all the issues that listeners know very well. The catastrophe is pretty much unmanageable. And that means that we will see bigger numbers coming to Calais in the future.
Shashank, in dealing with this, from the perspective of the British government particularly, how constrained are they and how constrained should they be by the relative lack of sympathy, I think it's fair to say, among the British electorate for these people?
I think there's two issues here. One of them is how well do we truly understand what is going through their heads, what drives them here? And I'm referring here to the very widespread belief that these are economic migrants searching for work rather than asylum seekers fleeing grave persecution. I think we have a very poor public understanding of that basic question. And of course, you don't need me to tell you that's fueled by very, very poor, ill-informed tabloid analysis. I think the second issue, which is actually just as important, and you alluded to at the beginning, is do we understand how this burden is shared across Europe? There's no moral principle that says it must be perfectly equitable across Europe. But I think if we understood the difference in scale between what we here in Britain face and what Germany has taken in, what the Scandinavians have done, but particularly what Greece, which I think is at a time of grave economic and political turmoil, is facing the brunt of this. I think we would view this in a little more perspective and realize actually the proper response here may be to show more solidarity with other European countries and to retreat into this bunker that we have built for ourselves.
Oscar, though, if David Cameron did stand up in front of the British people and say, instead of what he said last weekend, was that these people are economic migrants and they want to enter Britain illegally, if he actually said pretty much what Shashank just said, which is that there really is, you know, a limit to how much we can do to stop these people coming, we are being asked to bear an extremely small percentage of the burden. Maybe we should try to think of a way to act with a certain degree of compassion and practicality towards them rather than hoping the problem goes away. How do you think that would actually go over with the British media and the British people?
I think some part of the British media, to which Shashank alluded to, would react very badly, but not so the British people. I am much more confident on the ability of the British people to react to carefully reasoned and also to the fact that this is an emotionally charged humanitarian catastrophe. In fact, we're already seeing evidence of that. There is the case of the Facebook-based movement that is donating musical instruments to those in Calais. They're going back there. They're also collecting tents and going to Calais, giving them to those who are waiting there for future or no future. So I am much more optimistic about the possibility that if the British public were told the truth about what is happening in Europe, we will see a very different reaction.
I think it's also worth remembering that the government's just won an election. It's won a majority, and I'm aware that it's a very slender majority, that there's a vocal backbench I mentioned earlier on, but there's a long time before they face the electorate again.
Just final thought on this, Shashank. Do you think that there is anything for them to be gained by trying a slightly less pull-up-the-drawbridge approach?
I think there's a political calculation domestically, which is you attract a lot of centrist voters. And more interestingly, I wonder how it would go down in Europe in terms of renegotiating our position in Europe and whether showing some good faith now would reap dividends for Cameron in renegotiating the UK's terms of the EU in a few months' time.
And it's also very important because it would mean we will already be facing what is going to happen in the future. This problem will not go away, so we need to change our minds about it.
Indeed not. Frontex, the EU's border Border Agency recorded a record high of 107,500 migrants at Europe's borders in July, and those were just the ones who made it that far. We will have to leave it there. Shashank Joshi, Senior Research Fellow at RUSI, Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Senior Lecturer in Law at Birkbeck University, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's episode. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Elena Nikulacheva, and Federica Romaniello. Third time trying. I'll get it right one day. Our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. For the next half hour, Chris Lord will keep you company with Monocle's international playlist from our Istanbul bureau. At 1900 hours, it's The Urbanist. At 2200 hours, I'm back with Emma Nelson for the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow. For this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks very much for listening.